You're now listening to the No GPS podcast with hosts Mez and Aaron. Remember to share, like, subscribe, and follow. Got a show idea, complaint, interesting take, or just want to say what's up? You can reach us at nogpspodcast@gmail.com. Enjoy the show. With the white top, baby. When I wake up, it's enemy, yeah. And it's running because of me, yeah. And a red, yeah, it's all I see. And if you're rich, yeah, 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 yeah. And if you're rich, yeah, 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 yeah. And if you're rich, yeah, 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 yeah. And if you're rich, yeah, 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 yeah. And if you're rich.
Yo, yo, let's do it again. Let's do it again. I come with
the shit that's right. Hello, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whatever it is for you. It's No GPS. It's me and my co-host, my main man, my best friend, I can say, Mr. Mez. In the place to be today, special day. I think, Mez, you sent me the trailer to this movie in October.
Oh, okay.
Of last year. And I was geeked when I seen it. I was like, oh my gosh. My favorite actor, Jeffrey Wright, who I just adored his acting from, like, when I was a kid. Those sleepy Saturday and Sunday afternoons in the summer where you have nothing to do and nobody's outside and you're just watching TV. And I used to watch Channel 28, Fox, and they would have these movies come on, and it was reoccurring movies like Basquiat. They played a lot. I had no clue, of course, as a young man, who the hell Basquiat was. I was like, man, this guy is crazy. And who is this white guy with this blonde hair acting strange? You know, you know, obviously Andy Warhol. And I was like, man, this guy's next level. And then the next movie I seen him in, and I was like, yo, this is crazy. Was it Ride with the Devil? Came out like 99, 2000. These are movies like they just always is like Sunday, Saturday afternoon matinee. And I would watch these and see Jeffrey Wright. And I remember watching Shaft and not even knowing that that guy was the guy who played Basquiat.
He had like a makeover in that one, right? He looked different.
Yo, he's so versatile. It's just actually, yeah, that's one of his calling cards. So the movie is American Fiction. We're talking about American Fiction today. Directed and I believe written the screenplay by Court Jefferson, who's award-winning screenwriter or TV writer. For shows like Succession, I believe he won the award for The Watchers. Before that, he was a journalist, and then I think he was an editor with Gawker as well. So this guy's been out there doing his thing for a minute. So he puts this thing together. It's an adaptation, of course, of a novel called Erasure by a gentleman named Everett Percival. And he takes that and he mixes and molds it for a new generation or a new time. And I guess we'll talk about the return of the same or movies that did similar things as this one. The predecessors. And Court is very, very honest about that. He talks about the movies that really influenced him. He always brings it up. So, yeah, we're here to talk about this. So the movie's essentially about a novelist who's fed up with the establishment profiting from black entertainment. And he uses a pen name to write a book that propels him into the heart of hypocrisy and madness he claims to disdain. It's a satirical, tragic comedy, a film that can make you laugh, and then, of course, as I was telling Mez before this, can make you cry. Well, at least for me.
I think you were the tears of sadness. I was the tears of laughter, because I really thought I liked how funny it was.
You know what got to me, and this is probably why, you know, certain quarters don't like it, or have said certain things about it, you know.
Oh, is it some certain things is going to be said.
Yeah. So for me, like, there's a story about a family, and then it's a story about an artist trying to get his work recognized and not fall into the tropes and stereotypes that, you know, befall or belittle black artists, black writers, black creatives. And so he goes through this world, and he's trying to navigate it and figure it out. And he's going through a family tragedy, seemingly one after the other. And so Jeffrey Wright plays the main protagonist of the film, as Thelonious Monk. His sister is played by
Thelonious Monk Ellison.
Oh yeah, sorry about that. The Thelonious Monk Ellison, of course. You got to put the writer in there, not just the jazz guy.
But that's what I'm saying. What a hodgepodge of uppityness.
That's crazy, right? I mean, yeah, like, it's, you know, when you find out in the book, he's originally from DC. So when I went to go watch the film, I was like, oh, it's in Boston? I'm like, oh. So, you know.
Well, in the book, he's from DC?
Yeah, in the book, he's from DC. So he goes, when he goes back home, he goes to DC. So it's a real, obviously, it was Chocolate City back then.
Right, but did they move it to Boston, specifically that part, that coastal town, because they wanted to make a point about a little known black community there that was well off, that nobody, because, you know, you associate Massachusetts with particular kind of whiteness. Yeah. And even the black folks, I think, don't they mention that in the movie, when they do they mention what's one of those areas in Boston, sorry, Benzino's old group shout out in their song.
It's like, you got Roxbury.
Is it Dorchester or Dorchester?
Yeah, it's Dorchester.
So is that the black one, and then someone says it's no longer black anymore or something like that? That was in the movie, right?
Yeah. Which means it got gentrified. Yeah,
exactly. So I feel like, you know, I haven't done the research of this, but did they pick that town because to offset that, you know? Well, we're not going to talk about Dorchester. We're going to talk about this place, this overlooked place where black people have inner lives and, you know, normal problems like everyone else does.
Right. They don't suffer from pathology. Exactly. Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think it does have a little bit to do with, I think Jeffrey Wright was so involved in this movie. We'll talk about that later. Like, for him, what I heard him say in an interview was that it was kind of full circle. So I think his favorite two roles to play was Basquiat and this role as Thelonious Monk Ellison, right? And so there's a connection between those two characters. It's strange. And watching the movie again, I actually heard him speaking, and I'm like, damn, he's doing a Basquiat voice sometimes.
I haven't seen that film. When did that come out? You know the year?
Came out, I think, 1996, okay. 97, 96, around that time. Yeah, so I think they choose that area. Obviously, there's a Du Boisian thing to it. W.E. Du Bois, obviously, from New England. And so when I'm talking about Jeffrey Wright involved in this, is that obviously he played a character that I really liked on Boardwalk Empire, Dr. Valentin Narcisse.
Who is Du Bois if he was bitten by a vampire or something.
He's based on Du Bois, right? And Du Bois, the whole concept of the talented 10th and all of that kind of stuff. So this movie tries to move from that kind of respectability politics. And so you put it at the center and the core of what that is, as far as that concept of the talented 10th and respectability politics. And I think Cord even talks about this. He said him and Jeffrey were talking about it, like, we can't make this about respectability politics. And I also think that that's probably not why you see the father. Not even a picture. Maybe a picture, but not really.
You know, the picture of the on the book, the cover is a little black boy with a gun on his head.
Right.
And in the movie, I think intimated that he shot himself. Right?
Yeah. He took his own life.
Right.
So the father's not represented in that sense there. And I think that it allows certain narrative things to happen without the policing of the father, as far as the black father has been, whether black sitcoms or movies, right? You look at like Denzel Washington, and I didn't really think about it until I looked like at his filmography, the list of films he's done, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like a majority of these have him playing a cop.
Oh, yeah.
Same with Sidney Poitier. I mean, the list goes on. Jared Sexton talks about this, right?
And Jared Sexton lists them all out, and it's he's either a soldier, he's some kind of gun of the state.
Right. So he's there in a sense to police himself, police others, police his community, police his family. And so that father figure is not there, he's absent. And so that everybody, you know, Thelonious or Monk and his brother, right, they have this the relationship that's discordant, that Monk is very distant, but in the movie there comes that moment of, you know, catharsis between them. It's difficult, it's hard, but they come to it. But they're both father brothers to each other, right? Like that David Marriott talks about. So they're raising each other. You can see it.
You talking about the brother?
Yeah, the brother, right? And so the Cliff is his name.
Yeah.
Played by Sterling K. Brown. You know, excellent. Like, he killed it.
He was funny as well.
Yeah, he was really funny. Really funny. He needed that comedic element because, goodness gracious, the movie was tapping in on a certain level, on that familial dynamic. But yeah, like, there's a lot there. So this character is you remember how the beginning of the movie goes?
What happens? Well, with the student, the blue-haired student. The triggeredness on behalf of the black people, even though it's the black person who's telling you that it's kosher in this classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And but then within those first 5 minutes, what I remember from the opening is that it is announced from the get-go, Thelonious Monk Ellison does not believe in race.
Yeah.
As a category, what does that even mean? Is he saying, I don't believe it as a category, I don't believe it to be a thing because it's scientifically unviable, not viable?
Right.
Or is he saying, race is over with, we're post-race? By being that kind of character, is Jefferson writing him to allow himself to delve into issues of middle class neurosis or middle class stuff? So the avenue of upper class drama is now available to him because he's put the race thing to the side. But obviously, race comes at him from the outside, so he has to now deal with it, and shenanigans ensue.
Oh, yeah, a lot. And as he says, I don't even believe in race, right? To his publisher, you know, the taxi flies right by him to go to the white guy. That was funny. That was pretty funny to me. He looks perplexingly on, like, what?
So I think when that character says so of himself, I think a lot of what I've heard from some people, that what they want the movie to be, misses the point. Because he's not interested in the things you're interested in politically. He's not interested in that at all. He's just a boring literary professor going through part of his life that is he's at a crossroads, career wise, family wise. And I think the film is trying to say this age old thing. You know, this is I revisited Richard Eyton, his book, The Black Fantastic, because I always think about, when a demand is made on behalf of a whole race, it's usually a class, a section of a class that makes that demand that's audible enough to make that demand. The class that isn't audible enough to make that demand, or whatever demand they might have, is usually the more visible one, which becomes the stand-in stereotype for the whole of the class. So there's like a dissonance between who speaks for the whole race, a certain class, and then which part of that race gets seen as the prototypical, stereotypical kind of standard version of that race is the lower class. So in this case, Ellison hates the fact that the whole world throws at him a stereotype that he does not even recognize, and therefore his responses are always classed. So my issue with this movie was definitely the retreat into a kind of class, upper class kind of desire of, can't we all just make the same kind of movies, get praised and critiqued for the same kind of films? Why must we always perform the kind of bottom of the barrel kind of version of things?
And that's what Golden Centauro, the character played by Issa Rae, kind of checks him on, right? Like, he's like, we have so much potential, and she's just like, well, that means that you think that we have a problem, that we're not good as we are, right? And he's like,
yeah, but you're jumping to the end of it. Her character made no sense to me first of all, the movie as an adaptation for a book that came out in 2001 didn't make sense to me because it's still dealing with stereotypes from that book would be dealing with.
Yeah, it was like showing clips from like Boys in the Hood and everything like that.
Boys in the Hood, like, are you telling me this guy's so stuck in his, in his own corner that he doesn't even recognize things have since moved on to something else? Or are you telling me, are you showing yourself your own kind of blind spots that if you're going to update this book, you had to update it to 23 years later, because nobody talks like that. I think I spoke about this to you before. The critical darling of the literary kind of establishment, the New York Times bestseller list, who comes from an African American, people of color background, it's not that kind of book anymore. It's not Push.
Right.
It's something like Zadie Smith or something like that. It's actually very middle class.
Right.
And testimonial and confessional. This is where I grew up. My father was black. My mother was white. We moved from the South. That kind of, very, very genteel, very of our time, very part of the academic status quo. I mean, a lot of black feminists, kind of middle class, upwardly mobile. writers are the ones who are the darlings. So in a weird way, they put Issa Rae to look that part, but the book she was reading, the kind of Push stuff that Erasure was basing itself on,
right,
was responding to, that book doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. If so, mm-hmm. The stereotype, the white people just want to hear immiseration. I don't know if that's true anymore.
I think Tyler Perry's actually took that. I didn't really know,
right,
that.
Right, but then you know who looks... But that tells you something. The people who look down on Tyler Perry are black people.
Those Zadie Smiths and the Kenya Barrises. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So we moved up. Everyone has moved up a level. Yet this book has not updated itself to that. Tyler Perry is looked down upon by other black people. I don't think white people even really I mean, if he wasn't so rich, I don't think white people would even mention him.
I was reading somewhere that white people really do love his movies. I didn't know this. I thought he always says my niche is just black people. It's the theater and the churches and that's how we came up and now and we're doing this. And I was reading something like a big slice of his audience is white people who want to see black people depicted like that.
I haven't seen
also that. Another thing to kind of tie in something to New England. You remember the Beer Summit with Obama, Henry Louis Gates, and officer from the Boston area? I think Skip Gates was Henry Louis Gates was going to his house, and the guy he forgot his keys, so somebody called in on him. All of that, and it was a big whole uproar about it. So this is kind of presenting the blackness in the mold of the Obamas. And the Obama era and those aspirations and those desires, especially from black millennials, right? So I think for Cord, it very much made sense for him as he was growing up and what he saw and what he thought was like debasing and, belittling and demeaning, right? So maybe this was like, this kind of seems like a passion project for him. So it's like, it's tapping on something, but it's kind of out of step, out of line.
What is his age? What is generation? What did he see as demeaning? Hip hop, gangster rap? What?
Of course, yeah. I mean, those movies like that, the Boys in the Hoods, the Get Rich or Die Tryings, all of that shows the supposed pathology of black working class life and culture. You know what I'm saying?
But Ellison isn't working class.
Yeah.
If it was a working class black character who is the center, the vehicle of this movie, I would get it, but then that would also require a lot more nuanced writing about the character. I think it wants to do there's that famous kind of, it's almost like a slogan now, everybody kind of goes by this even if they don't know it. The particular is the universal. Like, to get through to the universal, you have to go through the particular.
Right.
Marvel even goes by this. You go through the particular experience and through a genuine, authentic kind of exploration of that particular, we all understand each other better, and then the universal kind of is all the more better for it. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a universal understanding, or, more or less, anyways. And I think that's what this movie wanted to do. But to do that, then, is to find the middle ground. Find a character or a group of characters or character and their family that are, middle ground. They have enough money so they don't have money problems. Well, and if they do, they have, they they're the kinds where, like, you know, you lose your job and your mortgage might be under threat or something like that.
Do you think the bridge for that was a character that Erica Alexander played, Coraline? In a sense, because she's a lawyer, but she works in Quincy. So I'm thinking Quincy is probably a working class city. And she kind of talks to him and tries to bring him down to earth, right? Monk is an idealist, right?
I think he's hinting at it.
Yeah.
Doesn't she defend? What doesn't she defend?
Yeah, she defends the book. Yeah.
Who, the defendant? Criminals?
Yeah, she defends. She's a criminal. Yeah, she defends criminals.
And he puts her on the spot saying, how do you defend them knowing that they did it or something like that? Was that what it was?
Yeah, she said everybody's guilty.
Right, so she's doing it for the money. She's not helping people out.
No, not necessarily. I think she's more genuine about it. But she's trying to help. I think by saying everybody's guilty is saying that even if they're guilty, they still need help and they deserve a second chance. I believe she did put that forth, right? So she's there to kind of center him and ground him. And he doesn't like it. He fights past it. He starts to get distant. He starts to do the things that he does, right? As Monk, right? Be condescending, speak down.
Yeah, they're throwing things at him. You know, his sister is supposed to let us know that there's an aspect that he's neglected. Coraline is supposed to show us another aspect that he's neglected. His brother, the caretaker, right? What's her name?
Yeah, Lorraine. Yeah.
Lorraine, he didn't know anything about her inner life and stuff like that. But I think it just mimics a kind of melodrama that we've known from white movies. You know, a lot of 80s white movies explored this kind of family dramas and conflicts. Regrets and heartaches and redemption stories and things like that. And I think, and this is why I went back to Richard Eyton.
Yeah.
I feel like there's always been a kind of demand in African American society since post-civil rights to be seen as respectable, to be seen as human, to be seen in the same vein as you would see a white person. To not judge us based on our color, to not judge us, to point us out from the crowd, and with the explosion of the visual medium and black exploitation, two things happened. All of a sudden, everybody got to see a whole lot of black folks. All of a sudden, just there was a surplus of black visuals, black right. bodies, black voices, black music, but not the kind that people wanted. This is just showing us in our worst light.
Yeah, Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby had to come out with a trilogy in the 70s to kind of save the race. Yeah, it's let's do it again. Right. A piece of the action. Yeah.
The image was at stake, you know, we wanted this, but we didn't want this, you know. So there's two different kinds of representations. There's right. the one where we've been invisible, so see us, if you only could see us, right?
Invisible Man, Ellison. Ooh.
Right. Ooh. And then there's another kind of representation. You're seeing the wrong version of us. So this is
right.
more about accuracy and about correction and things like that. And as a matter of fact, the Eyton chapter is "Let Them Only See Us." And I don't know if it's he who meant it, or over the years I've just chewed over this title in my head, that I've created this in my own interpretation. Depending on which word you stress, it's a different meaning. Let them only see us. Right, there's a narcissism there. Don't let only see me, please. I mean, and Eyton, you know, rest in peace, he talks about this explosion of the visual media, like the visual in the 80s and 90s because of MTV and people breaking into Hollywood and the distribution logistics and stuff being faster and faster. God, he would not have been ready for what was to come with the internet.
Oh, goodness.
And TikTok. And, you know, we had a second. And he compares that era to the Harlem Renaissance, the sudden kind of proliferation of black images and voices.
It's interesting.
And I, you know, me and you always say we live in a new kind of negritude era right now where you see one symptom would be a lot of people are learning about black vernacular through Twitter, black Twitter.
Right, right.
And TikTok and things like that. So people are getting it even faster than before.
Right.
You
didn't have to go to the other side of town anymore.
Yeah. black people are being immediately like stars overnight and overwritten at the same time, because right. now everyone else gets to say it. everyone else just learned it from you immediately. And then the complaint happens right afterwards, you know, appropriation, da da da.
Remember that she was in what was that Marvel film?
Aquafina, Shang-Chi.
Yeah, I don't know why it just escaped me, but yeah, her. Like people are like, well, yo, you know, they really got on her about that, and it's kind of like
yeah, it's just an ongoing thing, like yeah. an ongoing kind of back and forth, back and forth. It's like it happens in generations, in, right. in phases.
Yeah,
and then yeah, so let them only see us would be a narcissistic claim of being in the spotlight.
Right.
But then let them only see us is, let them only see us is the first one. Let them only see us would be, if they only could see us for who we are, you know, if only in that kind
of
sense.
Right. Right.
So there was always like this thing, you know, we don't want to be criminals and pimps and victims, and then came the horror movies of the 80s, 70s and 80s. We don't want to be the first one to die.
Right.
The only ones to not make it. You know, almost like canary in the coal mine, you know. Mm. we bringers of doom, like a herald of doom.
Right, right, right. You see that black character on the TV, you know death is imminent.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's always been a demand to be seen in a particular light. And, you know, emphasis on light.
Yeah. I mean, think about it with this character, just to kind of just cut him for one second, is he, when he goes into the bookstore to search for his books, when he goes back to Boston, he goes to the mythology section, right? Because he writes very esoterically. He writes about all these different things. He says, like, the only black thing about my books is the ink. And that's why I say he's an idealist. He's interested in myths. He's interested in, you know, higher level or highbrow theorizing. And I think for him, he's trying to do the right thing because he should be making new myths, right? Because that's what Armin White talked about in that Color Purple article he came out with back in the 80s. Is for him, that was like one of the first movies outside of Sounder where he was like, there wasn't a white antagonist that was central or the centerpiece of the movie. And black characters were able to create new archetypes, new myths, right? And so Monk is trying to do this, but he's flying too high in the sky, right? He's kind of like Icarus. He can't see reality and then tap into the zeitgeist and then bring in those new myths so that people can be seen for the complex beings they are.
Mm-hmm. The movie doesn't show us more than that, though. They don't show us what he writes about, what he's interested in. I think the book actually publishes, includes in the writing, the whole of my pathology apparently is in the book.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And then there's like lectures and speeches and notes and stuff like that. That because you know there's that whole metafiction thing.
Yeah.
They Percival Everett wanted to show what kind of the differences in conventions of writing. Like the different kinds of writing, which, in order for the reader to understand what's being expected, what's being seen as professional, respectable, what's being seen as what's being desired by publishers, that kind of stuff. So, but in the movie, I don't remember having a good idea of what kind of books he writes.
I mean, he was writing a book called The Persians, and then he was writing other books too, like based on Greek mythology. So it's kind of like the Fanonian, kind of like you're putting on a pedestal the Greco-Roman lineage or that history.
Well, that's fine. Yeah. That's fine because it continues, starts a thread at least that ends with him looking at that image at the end with the black kid
who picks
the white doll.
Yeah.
And which is the image he sees after Issa Rae's character tells him off.
Because she tells him, are you doing this for, like you said, I want to be fully seen by the world, by white people.
By white people, yeah.
Right. And so she's kind of like, well, like, but she's saying, I'm going to give the market what the market needs. And then like, why are you trying to do all of this?
Yeah, that was my least favorite. That's when I thought, man, the last time, she's always seems to be at the crime scene for me, Issa Rae. There's a moment in her show that where they flipped everything over the head, over, you know, on its head. In terms of like power dynamics and who gets to say what about race, this and that, and they gave the, yeah, I'm not gonna go into that, but her show is terrible.
I couldn't finish it. Yeah.
And in this one, she gets to be the the bad writer who we don't even know if she's doing it to sell out, or she has a good head on her shoulders and she's doing it, you know, to play the game. We don't know. All we know is he stammers and hesitates as he challenges her through the conversation, the meeting.
Yeah.
She's defensive. And she even contradicts herself after, you know, later on when she starts to challenge him. Mm-hmm. And we're not left with, we're left with who is this person? Like, who is she? What is she representing this? How is she an alternative to what he's doing? How does she see the world differently than what he is? All she does is, like, that's why even her challenge for him doesn't really drop heavy for me. I was just like, wait, what? Answer the questions that he's asking you.
Yeah.
And you haven't. We're just kind of left with, yeah, okay, we've now figured out that he has probably an unconscious desire to be accepted by a white world, which he sees as normative. He just wants to be normal. He just wants to be accepted in that without the color of his skin getting in the way.
It's a new black, almost in the mold of blackish, you know, just we're new blacks, right? I think Pharrell came up with that term, but...
This is why you should talk about, you should hype up your own article, which wrote about black mediocrity. And how that is enough, for God's sakes.
Obviously, Black AF. So Kenya Barris wrote Black AF, even starred in it. And, you know, people were going crazy about it. I said, all right, let me watch this. And I watched it and I said, wow, this is rich with meaning. Like, you don't just throw this away. You got to dissect this. You got to look at it. You got to sit with it. You got to figure it out. You got to sift through it. And so for me, what I found in it was a character played by Kenya Barris, who was deeply, deeply like affected by him not getting acknowledged by the white world, like him not getting an Emmy in his contemporary. This is Steve Lathan, Leviton. You know, the guy who created Modern Family, right? Like, he's stunting on him. He's coming, like, I don't know. He was riding some kind of crazy foreign sports car, chains, diamonds, gold glistening in the sun. And he sees this guy, and he's driving maybe, I don't know, it's an Acura or a Honda Civic.
You know what's funny?
Yeah.
This scene you're describing sounds like something out of a hip-hop beef or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly
so these
that,
guys
right?
aren't that different.
No, he's, like, deeply neurotic. He's always, like, over and about just trying to figure it out. And for him, what he learns is he cares too much about what white people think about him. And he's just so affected by it. And every single episode of that show started with because of slavery. So it's the nihilism, the reactionary politics or ideas that he espouses, right? Like, he understands the issue. He just doesn't have a solution to the problem. And then that gives him an issue because he... And it's funny because Tyler Perry actually comes on the show and, like, he was the one character who actually had it together. And he told him, like, hey, you're looking for recognition in all the wrong places, like... You got your community, stick by that. And I'm like, wow, Tyler Perry came in here and was like, the one with insight? That was like funny to me.
But he probably just means come back to church.
Yeah. No, exactly. And so, yeah, that was an interesting show in the sense that they were so mediocre. And for me, it was the death of Cosby or Cosbian respectability politics, because you had this guy and you had his family and they were just... exorbitantly rich, but they were mediocre. And I'm like, that's the American dream.
New Balance shoe dads.
Yeah, exactly. You destroyed the whole hashtag or the ideological work of black excellence, right? Which I believe is the Cosbian ethos of, you know, respectability politics that he was putting down on people. And, you know, Cosby makes appearances as far as his influence on Kenya in the show, right? And so, yeah, you see all of these dynamics at work, and it's—I don't know—I thought it was fascinating, just the celebration of the mediocrity at the show.
So mediocrity is in opposition to a version of if they only saw us, they would see how excellent we are. You know, we are an excellence that's been submerged forcefully, and you can no longer put us down. So that's the Black Panther
100%. Yeah,
like a bubble that just came to the surface on automatic when that movie came out, right? The reason that movie was so successful is because of this pride. Like, look what we can do if
this
only.
Is us,
so,
yeah.
Like, Marvel didn't even have to market that film.
Yeah,
self-marketed, but we are enough, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we're enough, right? And I think what was fascinating about the response, because I've seen it on Twitter, just black people going crazy about it. Like, I hate this show. It's colorist. It's classist. It's this, that. But I'm like, oh, I don't think that's the real issue. I think that for us black millennials, there was a deep problem because what it celebrated was mediocrity. You weren't seeing the achievements of Beyonce or Serena Williams or LeBron James or Barack Obama, just, you know, all across the TV. You seeing people who were deeply flawed, who could not reason well, who were suffer from high levels of cupidity. You know what I'm saying? The kids don't even think they're black. The young kids don't even think they're black. They have a barbecue at the house and they invite all of their Inglewood family from the projects to blackify them.
Like, you're describing normative, boring American suburban life. You know, like, yeah. You've kind of made it. You don't have to worry outside of your regular worries. Race no longer has that pride place amongst all those worries. But I think this is where these things kind of, there's like a x-axis and a y-axis, because the ambition people, the people who are dying to, you know, raid this neoliberal tower and make it work for them,
yeah,
they have a word for that kind of white life that Kenya Barris would just like to mimic and be left alone with. They call it not normative, they call it basic.
Yeah, exactly.
This is their great big egoic kind of overcoming of the problem of whiteness. Instead of calling it normative, call it basic. So it's a y-axis. You know, yeah. They're not complex like us. Mm. They're basic like themselves. Mm. As opposed to on an x-axis, where it's like they're the standard, and then you fall short of it, or you know, or you can never kind of go beyond it because they're the standard. So that's, I think, the inherent response that you just mentioned. Like, oh, this show is not good, is because it's too basic. You know, we need to be what's this word I learned the other day? Effulgent. You know, we need to overflow ourselves. We have to be beyond our bounds of what we are. We need to really stretch.
Right.
But so yeah, so that's why I thought it'd be articles, because Monk is that kind of a person who would just like to be left alone and pursue something that's meaningful to him.
Right, not be bothered with race.
My issue with the movie as a film critic would be that it just does imitate a certain kind of. If this was a white family, it would just be a regular drama.
Yeah,
you would see it on. I mean, it would get money. It would get funding. I think Asian American diaspora films get a lot of these kind of opportunities as well. But for some reason, I think if you just change the race of these people into white, it would just be any typical come home for Christmas type of drama. And it's weird even to call it that. It's like Tyler Perry does those kinds of films.
Right, right. But that's what Cord and them were saying on the press run, right? That's like the universal element to this is, this could be anybody's family.
But yeah, but why should I give you kudos for being the black person doing that? Like, is that your final kind of resting place for your racial lament, like complaint? Is we also want to be normal. We're right, the last ones to get to be normal. But then the movie you put out better be good, because then you're just imitating other movies that have also done it. Like, what's the different thing about you? And I would think that they would probably say the metafiction part of it. Because, you know, why do they call it an American fiction? Why not African American fiction? I don't know. Maybe, but right. It's just like they want to eat their cake and, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it. Yeah, yeah. They want to be just like everyone else, but they want to be just black enough.
But be unique.
So that. Yeah. So they could have that cool scene in the middle where he's writing, and these gangster pages are really coming to life. You know, there's a lot of talk about deadbeat dads, and going into his own psyche about, I guess, what he thought about his dad and stuff like that. But I don't know. It's it left me a bit halfway there where they wanted to go. It's been a while since I watched it, so maybe at the time I did leave it a bit more disappointed. But now with more time passed, I guess I'm a bit, whatever.
I think for me, like seeing it recently, when I watched the film, it got the family parts got to me in a sense, just because, you know, like our families tried to go back home, try to come back, get together. Then we got scattered again. And then, you know, I haven't seen you face to face for 22 years now. So that part got to me when they got together and figured it out, especially the wedding scene. And even before that, when Lorraine, Coraline, and Monk are in the car going to the house, and they just dropped off the mother, played by Leslie Uggams, at the old folks' home, where she's getting specialized care because she is suffering from Alzheimer's. You know, when they're in the car, and Lorraine, the caretaker of the home, she's known Monk since he was a young baby, or he had really had a hand in raising him. And I seen that figure, who normally is typically just stereotyped as the mammy figure, she's just there for others. And they're in the car driving back, and she tells them, "Hey, I'm gonna get married, guys." You know, and Monk and Coraline, they're just ecstatic, over the moon, almost like hitting the car horn. And they say, "Let's celebrate it. Let's celebrate it right now." And she's like, "I don't like to be the center of attention. No. And I'm like, "No, you need to be." And she was. They show her getting married, the dancing. We were just talking about the song. We're like, "Yo, what song was that? Because I need that song too. That's a great song that they played."
That's something I have to find out.
I thought that was beautiful, as far as taking that figure that had been, you know, stereotyped, troped, just there for others. And she was invested with her own private wants and desires. That was great.
I think that's been a staple recently, especially like TV or movies. But in order for a kind of certain kind of film to be successful, everyone's inner life has to have gotten a kind of mention, kind of or an arc, and that's been kind of a staple recently, that if you're going to cast a black woman in your mainly white cast, then she has to have an inner life. She has to have an arc. She has to have a reason for being there, other than just being there for the main protagonist. If you're going to have a black man or whatever it might be, not indigenous, or if your movie involves them, you better give them something, right? Okay. And I think this, in American Fiction, that was there. I think this is the thing. This is the neurosis of a middle class person. Like, I've written. I want to write about capable characters that enable me to spread my wings as a writer.
Yeah,
you know, they have to be a certain. You know, I've maybe said this to you before. Like, I feel like there's a rule: if you're gonna be a writer, a fiction writer, you got to make your characters able enough, capacious enough, in order to get them to places, you know, so that the reader doesn't ask questions like, "Wait, how did they get the money for that?" Mm. Well, you get that out of the way by saying, "Oh, he's a doctor, or he's a lawyer,
right?
Or he comes from money." So that just covers up a big hole, right? Now money's not a problem in your story. That's what I mean. But when you want to start with that kind of a middle class writer in today's world, you might get criticized for writing about uppity people. Mm. So what do? You add a caretaker. Mm. And what do? You humanize the caretaker.
Right.
And you give her some reason for being there and for being meaningful and stuff like that. So I think that was their way of doing that. I wasn't that impressed with it, even though I liked it.
It was beautiful.
I wasn't that impressed with it. I was more interested in why there's so many black people living in this rich-ass seaside town in Massachusetts. Why everybody...
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. That was very interesting. I don't think about that when I think about Massachusetts. No.
Yeah, and their drama is about siblings now having to decide whether they sell a house or not, or you know, that kind of stuff. We've seen that before. It's just not maybe. And we have, you know, the movie actually reminded me of, this is the another part of the conversation today that I wanted to outline. It's that. So earlier I said Everett was responding to Menace to Society, Boys in the Hood in the early 90s, and Push. I feel like there is another kind of arc that starts with Hollywood Shuffle. And then ends with Bamboozled.
And those were the movies I was talking about, predecessors, and he acknowledges them. Not Bamboozled, but Hollywood Shuffle.
How do you not? How do you not acknowledge Bamboozled?
I mean, haven't heard him say Bamboozled. That's interesting.
Delacroix, is that his name? Pierre Delacroix.
Maybe that story was too tragic at the end. How it ended, I don't know.
But Pierre Delacroix is the names are almost the same. Pierre Delacroix and Thelonious Monk Ellison, they are the same. I'm telling you. But there was I think it was time for that kind of a response to the 90s. So Erasure coming out in 2001, Bamboozled coming out in 2000.
Right.
So like I say, I don't know why 23 years later, Jefferson couldn't respond to something in between then and now.
So he says maybe this was his Hollywood Shuffle, because for him, that's a seminal film. That's the film when he was a kid, like, that he couldn't get enough of. I mean, for me, I didn't know about Hollywood Shuffle until maybe way late. I didn't grow up even knowing about that film. Maybe Armin White introduced it to me. I'm not even sure. Maybe you did. But he grew up with it. And so that influenced him. And so maybe this was that version of it for him.
Another one is Aaron Magruder's Boondocks. So all these people were responding to the this oversaturation, this desire for white people to see black people in a certain kind of way over and over and over again. It's the 70s all over again. We have a little bit of Cosby in the 80s. That's allowed. But the rest is, and then all of a sudden, boom, NWA come out, and now everybody has to, every new generation director wants to make that kind of a film. What's his name? I have to find his face. This is the movie that it reminded me of, especially when they're in the seaside.
I know what you're going to say.
The Inkwell.
Yeah.
The Inkwell is one of my favorite films, and the director,
100%.
Matty Rich. Matty Rich made a movie called... He only made two films in his entire career. He disappeared after Inkwell. Wow. He made a kind of critical darling, you know, festival darling film called Straight Outta Brooklyn, which Armin White hates with a passion because it's he thinks it's poverty porn, a culture of poverty type of, you know, fodder that white people fawn over because they'd like to see you in a certain way.
He got
such a push out of that movie that he made this other movie called The Inkwell, which was a lot more nuanced. It had nothing to do with what those two movies. You wouldn't think that they were made by the same person, but nobody saw The Inkwell. Nobody gave it any mind.
I watched that on
disappeared
like
in the shuffle
Friday nights on BET, right? You know what I mean? 10 o'clock movie, 9 o'clock movie.
Yeah, but it's the kind of film that you would see.
It's amazing. Yeah.
I don't know. So it was a middle brow white story about a family traveling to for summer to another part of the country to meet up with other families, and then there's a young protagonist that we see the world through who doesn't understand the divisions between the families, between the adults, and things like that. And it takes place in the 70s. Where there's a kind of defeatism in the air for black radicals, but also a lot of ambition, a lot of newfound private propertied and moneyed
black
folks on the other side. So you have when you have those two in the same.
It was like there was one family, you know, Joe Morton,
heading that
as the upper class, middle upper class family, and then the other one with Glenn.
And they're married to the same sisters,
exactly,
right?
So that's the connection.
Yeah, and there's all this anxiety about responsibility towards your own wife, your own, you know, challenging your own masculinity,
right,
and having it challenged by this other man, and things like that. So
that was a great movie. Let's recommend that for people to watch, man. Inkwell. Jada Pinkett Smith is in it, and Lawrence Tate.
A lot of people. Leon is in it, right?
Dwayne Martin is in that. I think Morris Chestnut in that.
No, Suzanne Douglas is my favorite part of it. She, you know, may she rest in peace. AJ Johnson, Morris Chestnut. I think it was Morris Chestnut. Yeah, I just mistook one for the other because they're known for the same things.
It was the 90s. These guys are all playing the same type of roles.
But yeah, so what I'm saying is, now I've always said to you, early 90s is the gangster explosion.
Right.
And then the late 90s is the response. You know, we're doctors and lawyers and writers and photographers again with The Best Man and right. Love Jones. And
you got movies like
The Wood. And
The Wood, yeah.
Everything moved. And so Bamboozled and Erasure were satirical responses to that.
Never thought about that. It was a real response to what was happening in the 90s with all that nihilistic pop art coming out of
it. Yeah, so my main issue was that, the response. What is he responding to? What is he updating here? Is the complaint still the same old complaint? We are not being seen normatively, and if is normative, then a certain kind of classic American traditional idea of middle class. You have to be a doctor, and your brother has to be a professor, academic published writer, and your other brother has to be a surgeon. You know, is that the complaint still? Is that the lack of diversity? Because there's right. It goes back to the, I want to know what the demand is. They're not seeing enough of us, or they're not seeing
right,
enough
right.
diverse versions right. of us.
It was not phenomenal. In that sense, it's not phenomenological in that its relationship is, we don't know what it's bouncing off of, right? What was the thing that necessitated this to be made, right? And I think maybe the stuff in the background, behind the scenes. So that might be one thing. Another thing is, this is an interesting movie. I watched the Bob Marley movie. I've been watching some other, like, what's interesting now is, like, they're making movies about how people, it's not about the art, it's about how they're making the art.
Well, it is a meta story, right?
Right. So just like what's happening now is they're showing the process. And so maybe what's happening, what this response is what's happening in those meetings that we don't get to see, right?
But Bamboozled did that. The best part of Bamboozled is the meetings.
People got short memories and people are culturally illiterate.
Yeah,
well,
but that's what I'm saying. Like if creatively, then what are you adding to the canon, I guess? What is it that you're bringing new that's to the right. table that's different from what's been done before? And why? Well, this is okay. So this is the last bit that I had written down. I feel like the meta part of it. I questioned that too. Like, why go through the meta? So it's like what you said just now, right? Maybe it's to show you what's going on in the back rooms and whatnot, but you don't need to make it a meta kind of narrative in order to do that. You can just show those meetings.
Yeah.
I feel like meta is in right now. Everything is meta. I wrote something recently, like, I don't know, a year ago about a film, and which made me go through all the recent meta kind of films that had been released recently or stuff. See How They Run is a film that's very meta. The Matrix Resurrections, obviously.
Oh, that was hugely meta. I wrote about that too. Yeah.
The last two Scream. Well, I haven't seen the last one. The one before that, Scream itself was already a look at its like Wes Craven looking at the whole horror genre as a whole, and kind of deconstructing it through the first couple of films. But then the Scream.
Yeah. I got one thing to say. Like, do you think? It's like a meta narrative, right? Like you're talking about, almost like you're talking about yourself outside of yourself. It's deeply narcissistic.
Well, you're questioning the conventions of, like, so instead of just presenting something, you're questioning the way something is presented. Like so metafiction is right. fiction about how fiction is made. You know, its conventions and right. its rules and laws and how, and all that. So yeah, it is an bird's eye view, I guess. While you're also still making something. But so Scream, the last couple of the Scream 6, I guess it was. No, Scream 5. I don't know which one it was. That was a very... So that was a metafiction on something that was already a metafiction. So there's like a spiral happening, right? The recent Chip and Dale movie. There was a movie called The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. You have Marvel's She-Hulk.
Yeah.
You have Deadpool, which is coming out. Like with the third film next, so it's really in, you know, because we're very, very ironic now. We're post earnestness and post sincerity. We're always looking for the wink, right? But in American Fiction, I was wondering why he needed to insert that other than, again, having his cake and eat it, because he wants to let you know that I will not be able to publish something or release something if the white power structure doesn't like it. So he wants you to know, the viewer, that it's hard out here for a black person to write something that is personal to them unless the white power structure accepts it. They have to like it. They have to fawn over it. They're the ones that lubricate, you know, the vehicles of distribution. They're the ones who make it out. So when this movie comes out, he wants, you know, when someone picks up the movie rights for the book, for My Pathology in the film, at towards the end, they do this thing, right, where you no longer know whether we are talking to Court Jefferson or we're talking to Thelonious Monk. Monk. I just call him Monk. So, because we're not quite sure which ending did he go with. Is he trying to make a point about how American Fiction had to be released in a certain way? So basically, yeah. So the ending that just didn't. The irony for me is that this movie itself became like a critical darling and a Oscar nominated, several nominations actually across the different award shows.
Yeah, I think they got five.
Yeah, so just besides the Oscars itself. So, why is it like, in a way, Court Jefferson has to answer now why so many white people like the movie? Why did it cross over? I don't know if today's world, the word crossover has the same meaning. Because before, you needed your thing to cross over meant enough white people had to shell out in order for it to go pop. Nowadays, everybody got money in their pockets. So,
yeah, and the demographics are changed. Yeah, that's interesting. Why this movie? Why? I mean, obviously, amazing performances. Jeffrey Wright. He should be in more leading man roles, 100%. Erica Alexander, another breath of life. My favorite character from Living Single, Maxine Shaw. She was on The Cosby Show too. To see them back on the screen, and that was impressive. All the acting, Tracy Ellis Ross, Sterling K. Brown. I think if you just think about it from a technical perspective, it was well done, well put together. These were heavyweights who came together and did it, you know, what was not an indie, but it kind of feels like it was an indie the way they described making the film, right? But that's interesting. Why now? Especially in this very, very, this moment where the boomerang is coming back, right? Like you had the Black Lives Matters protests. You had all these corporations, all these people saying, we're going to dedicate this money, do this, that, whatever. And what you're seeing now is everybody recoiling back, you know, stepping back. And so this movie is somewhat of a reminder, you know, and maybe that race hustle industry is still up for grabs. Maybe still a lucrative industry to be a part of.
I'm interested in the demand. I can understand the demand for a black superhero movie. It's coming from a certain section.
Yeah.
Generationally, you know, youth culture, digital era. You know, black youth culture. I can understand the demand for African film, you know, but for this kind of film, I don't know which section of the crowd would have wanted it to demand a kind of metafiction on what gets published, what gets released, what gets funded.
When I went to go watch the film, I mean, it was all white people in there, right? And, you know, maybe they're not laughing as much because, you know, they see a black guy's around. But I think they're uncomfortable, but there's enjoyable parts. And I think that the sitcom element of the film, where the focus is on the family and the family dynamics, that melodrama, I think that makes it safe for, you know, non-black people to watch it.
Well, my theater was hootering and hollering. There was a lot of white folks, but that's because it was genuinely funny for everybody, I think. It's a very well-written, like, kind of comedic film. But yeah, generally, I've heard some people who are disappointed by its politics, but quote unquote.
Yeah.
But that's why I say the movie tells you in the first 5 minutes this man does not believe in race.
Right.
If you were taken in by it at all, it's because it worked on an aesthetic, on an artistic level. And I'm thinking of a certain someone I'm not going to mention, but they went from I love this because this person is me to I do not like its politics as soon as they hung out at the corner barbershop.
Got guilted and shamed about it, and I'm just like, yo, I feel no qualms about it. I like the film. It's not gonna do everything politically for me, but
it's not meant to. It's not trying to do that.
That's ridiculous.
That's you.
It's immature.
Only reading it through one lens, what was telling is that if it worked on any level, then it worked on the level that it should have, which is the artistic level. Right. But you're too politically gangster to admit it.
Scientific socialist.
Yeah, that was off the table for me. It's not saying something politically so that I can take it on that level. It's not doing that.
I put that
off the table. Yeah, yeah, so it just goes for that. Now I can just judge it purely as an artistic endeavor.
Right.
The kind of generic, you know, gambit is the meta part of it. Mm-hmm. And then everything that's been said about it, around it, you know, the discussion about we don't see these kinds of films, we don't see ourselves in this kind of sense. So that's the part I'm interested in. And I don't think it's set up to question in a well-versed kind of manner. And it definitely didn't answer it because it left things on the table. And it wasn't explicit with the white ghost in the shell problem of, Monk. It just pointed towards it, and a lot of people missed it. I heard one kind of review of it where they explicitly said the opposite of what was true in the film and in the book. They said in the book they make this more clear, apparently, but the movie fails at it. But the movie told it in a visual language. He steps out of the room and he sees the image of that doll, the white doll. Right. So that if you have to have it spelled out for you, then
you don't need it spoon fed to you all the time. And I think that's why movies are beautiful. Like, yeah. Yes. You want it to be pedantic, that would make it bad art. That would make it sermonizing.
Right? Yeah. In the end, great. Very funny film. I feel like Aaron Magruder would have made this film 20 years ago.
Yeah.
as it is, I'm interested in what Cord Jefferson does next. He's on my map now.
Yeah, So how do you feel that this film, just to kind of end it off with this, if it's the sun, the Hollywood shuffle, how do you think it represents? How do you think it pushes forward? Well, I know how you think it pushes forward, but like, what's your commentary on that? Like the comparison between the two?
Hollywood shuffle is more in your face. Mm-hmm. It's directly addressing the viewer. American Fiction tried to tell a story, but I think the story isn't uniquely uniquely universal, and it's not uniquely particular. It just kind of is, but it works on a certain level. I mean, it does what most good dramas do, which is make you feel for the protagonist by showing you their relationships, the nature of their relationships, the gaps in their memories and their traumas. Right. So it does that, but I don't know if it improved upon what Hollywood Shuffle made so biting.
Like, watch that, people, watch it. Hollywood Shuffle, great movie, starring Robert Townsend.
Bamboozled perfected it. I think Bamboozled perfected satire. I mean, it starts with the Delacroix looking into the camera and giving you a definition of satire.
Right.
And American Fiction is trying to do this meta thing, which is all the rage right now. And I don't know. The classism of it is very hard for me to shake. It seems to come from a certain place of, we are not ghetto bastards. We are, Maybe that's not entirely true. He is a bastard, right? No, he's not a bastard. He's not a ghetto bastard. But he does suffer from the affliction of absent dad or dead dad.
Yeah.
But the dead dad is dead in the stories that he abhors, but he's also dead in his own story. So
that's what I'm saying, that the father is missing. That's what started off with that. That's interesting. And then the father-brother relationship between Cliff and Monk, between Sterling K. Brown and Jeffrey Wright's character.
When Cliff says to him he wish his father had known that he was gay.
Right.
And that... does Monk tell him like you wouldn't have taken it taken it kindly or something like that?
Yeah, he says like that's the wedding scene, so you know.
Yeah.
Monk is kind of watching everybody have fun, and he's kind of he's enjoying it, but at the same time he's missing that Coraline's not with him. But so yeah, when they have the conversation, when Cliff or Sterling K. Brown's character comes up and talks to him, and just they're having a deep conversation, and he says like, hey, I wish he got to see me for who I am, and he said, you think that he would have accepted you? And then Cliff says, that's not even the point. At least he would have known as me. He would have rejected
the real me.
Right. And that was the point. See, the real me.
So that line made me think of another film that's out right now. I don't know if it's out in Canada. It's a British film. It's called All of Us Strangers.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, but so what I liked about that film is that it is able to bridge the gap between the particular story it wants to tell. It's about a gay character and his own relationship to his departed parents, like who died when he was young. And the film is kind of like in this suspended space between him longing for another moment with his parents, and so he imagines what kind of how they would have responded to him growing up and becoming the man that he's become, right? So it bridges both the difficult life of a gay man with the difficult life of a man who's never got to grow up with his parents. And that line that Cliff says is basically the main kind of through line for that film. It's called All of Us Strangers. And but that's what I was lacking here. There's nothing particularly black about the show, other than black people complain that their blackness constantly exceeds or supersedes them, in their relationship to the world. At least in Monk's case, obviously not the rest of them. I think the rest of his family is pretty copacetic with just being professional people, right?
Yeah.
Their problems are regular problems. So I mean, I have a lot of problems with it, but. a movie that makes you laugh, there's that line from the film Mank, the head of Metro, what's that studio called, Metro Goldwyn Mayer. The trick to getting to the audiences through their, he points at his head and then he points at his heart, his chest, and then he points at his groin. So if a film gets you in either one of those places, it has done its job, and this movie definitely hit the spot in that comedic area, wherever that might be.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Hey, go watch it. That's what we recommend, so we could talk about it with you intelligently. So to all our listeners out there, it's been a grand pleasure. Thank you for sticking with us this long, and we'll be back with more. But man, peace, blessings, harmony, goodness, and good health to all of you out there, Mez.
Peace and harmony.
Peace and harmony, man.
Mash off with it, cash out in, stash bot living with a white top fitted. Mash off with it, cash stop getting, stash bot living with a white top fitted. Mash off with it, cash stop. Stash bot living with the white top in it. Mash got with it. Cash stop in it. Stash bot living with the white top in it. When I wake up, it's Shannami. Yeah. And it running because Shami. Yeah. And a red yak is all I see. Yeah. And if you're rich, yeah. And if you're rich, yeah. And if you're rich, yeah.
come with a shit dash, scratch that. I come with a whip dash, lift ash. I come with a whiplash, hold back. I'm gone with a wind dash, dang. How long would the rain lash, vacant? How long would the pain lash? 20 years for some cash. I'm with it to live it. Good Lord, forgive it. Oh shit, I've been it. Usual politicking. I'm with it to live it. Good Lord, forgive it. Oh shit, I've been it. Usual politicking. Oh. I rumble the click, you know. I'm down with the shit. I'm humble a bit. I rumble a bit, you know. I'm done with the vintage. I'm new or rich, I glow. I fly through the body, that pain that get gone. Yeah, I stump for the real, yeah. I bump for the real, I dump for the real, got up for the real, yeah. They come for the real, yeah. It's time for the real, J-Lo for the real, Ja Rule for the real, yeah. Yeah. When I wake up, it's Shinami, yeah. And they're running because of me, yeah. And the red, yeah, is all I see, yeah. And they hear it, say, yeah, 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 yeah. Like one for the road, no time for the bull. Profitable, high five to the bro. Time for the growth, bye bye to the ghost. Die for the woke, I sleep in the cold. Deep in the dream, I'm deep in the cold. Vibe to the beat, I'm liable to go. Inception on DiCaprio. When I'm young, I throw it on a weed bag. When I mean, I throw it on a G-wag. For the love of money, dog, they scheme bad. For the fallen, we gon' run a seed bag. When I'm young, I throw it on a weed bag. When I mean, I throw it on a G-wag. For the love of money, dog, they scheme. Stash bot, living with no white top, bit, mask off, cash, stop, cash, stop, stash bot, stash bot, living with no white top, bit, mask off, cash, stop, cash, stop, stash bot, stash bot.